This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe.
So welcome to Marketplace's weekly Staff Picks Remarket podcast. It's the installment for Friday, March 30th. I'm Mitchell Hartman, a senior reporter based in Portland, Oregon. And I have to say, this is fun. It's also a bit funny for me to do this from my one-person bureau way up here in the Pacific Northwest. You know, I see the blizzard of emails every day to reporters and editors in our bureaus all around the world about what's on the shows and who we reached out to, what's coming up on the weekend. But like everyone on staff who doesn't actually go to the morning news meeting that sets the day's agenda and assignments, I don't actually know a whole lot about what goes on and what goes into every day's shows, the deliberations, the arguments, the switcheroos when we can't find, you know, CEO X or Y and it's 90 minutes before airtime. So listening back with a fresh ear to what came out of the radio has actually been a blast and also an eye-opener. Okay, so here's what opened my eyes and ears this week. First, a series from Marketplace special correspondent David Brancaccio of Economy 4.0. It's called Robots Ate My Job. David got in his car in New Jersey, and he's been driving cross-country with no company but a robotic dog and plans to make contact with no living, breathing, talking humans on the way. As he makes his way to the West Coast, he's reporting on robots and he's interacting with robots. He's given us full-length features on what jobs robots can do now and what they might be able to do in the future, also cool videos, and the voices of people whose jobs might be vanishing as robots take over.
It's day four after leaving the beach in New Jersey, and I'm outside Oklahoma City now. In 44 more miles, it'll be the halfway point. I'm taking my travel buddy, Wilson the robot dog, for a walk in the parking lot before getting back in the car. Try listening to that for another 1,600 miles. My silver plastic pal, in his own AA battery-powered way, is a very rudimentary virtual companion. And for people who know how to design, build, or operate more cutting-edge robots, it's a golden age of full employment, as I discovered before the trip when I visited one of the top robotics programs in the world. At least one of the receptionists at Carnegie Mellon University is a bit of an odd bird.
Hello. How may I help you?
Marion LaFleur, Tank to his friends, is an animated head shining from a nodding, swiveling computer screen. Got questions? He generally has answers.
So, Tank, I'm looking for room 2111.
I'll check. You can take the elevators down to the second floor where the room is located.
Tank is a project of Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute down the hall, where its students are working on some wild stuff. Snake robots that can squirm into tight spots for search and rescue. There's Herb, the robot butler, that can learn to navigate around the house to someday help people with disabilities. There are even robot stand-up comedians.
Any of you like television? I find it incredibly educational. Actually, as soon as someone turns it on, I go into the other room and read.
Okay, so not side-splitting. But that's not the point. In a world where humans and machines increasingly work together, robots have to learn to pay attention, to read social cues. Our economy may depend on it. And if you don't believe me...
Hello, hello, hello.
How about the President of the United States?
You might not know this, but one of my responsibilities as Commander-in-Chief is to keep an eye on robots. And I'm pleased to report that the robots you manufacture here seem peaceful.
Last June at Carnegie Mellon, President Obama announced a $500 million program to invest in new technologies. It's part of the administration's National Robotics Initiative to improve manufacturing, and the betting is to create jobs, not take them away, as so often is the worry with robots. And the demand for robotic skills is up by more than 40% this past year. Just look at the Where Are They Now alumni page on the Robotic Institute's website. Facebook, Intel, Google, talk about the economic winners. But it's important to realize that robotics isn't limited to PhD types working at the technological cutting edge at fancy universities.
The technical term for this robot is Godzilla.
That's David Novak Jr., He's 37 and a skilled maintenance technician at Toyota's motor manufacturing plant in southern Indiana. His job is to keep robots here working.
If, say, this robot doesn't pick up that part, I'm in there trying to figure out why.
He points to a flashing light on the overhanging panel.
That means there's a problem with that robot on that side of the line.
These robots are huge, like a T-Rex, and fast. At Toyota, robots do dangerous and repetitive work, lifting the underbelly of cars and welding the same parts again and again. Note also there are a few thousand human workers at this Toyota plant. And just a few weeks ago, the company announced 400 new jobs here. At Toyota, robot techs make between $42,000 and $69,000 a year, a very good wage for southern Indiana. Novak owns his home and is raising two daughters. He has a two-year associate's degree from nearby Vincennes University, specializing in robotics technology.
Like on this one right here, like program it over here and over there and run it back and forth at 100% speed.
Brett McCandless teaches robotics at Vincennes.
We'll do an assembly application where they incorporate the robot with a vision system to inspect parts.
He says nearly every week a company calls the school trying to hire his students, Toyota, Sony, Rolls-Royce. Vincennes Technology Associates degree program has a 95% job placement rate, and students make about $40,000 starting off. What we're experiencing here is the act of robots creating jobs, but that's not all they do to the workforce. It's late in the day, and McCandless stands in the hallway after class. When you think about how fast technology moves, he says, you start to see every job in a new light. Just then, a janitor pushes a vacuum round a corner.
You see that right there? Okay, that's a potential job to be replaced by a robot.
Right now, humans can use old-fashioned elbow grease to clean all kinds of nooks and crannies that robots can't. But what happens when the day comes when a robot cleaning crew becomes practical? It gives McCandless pause.
What do you care if it runs all day long? You're not paying it by the hour. It's scary, actually. Where do all these people go that we can replace with machines? I don't have the answer to that.
And when robots do take over our jobs, that's tomorrow. From the road, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And here's the robots segment that aired Tuesday morning.
My name's Jackie Gitzmed. I'm a cashier, and I've been with Ralph's for over 35 years.
And my name is Ashley Schwartz, and I've been with Ralph's for close to 6 years.
I've been doing this for over 35 years now, and if I didn't like to be with the people, my customers, I would have chosen something else.
I was raised as a grocery baby. My dad has been with Ralph's for 43 years, I believe.
And I, too, my father was in the industry for 50 years. So I'm second generation, actually third generation. My grandmother was a cashier.
I actually came from a store, a Ralph store, that didn't have self-checkouts, and now they do.
They call them robots. Each terminal is called a robot.
So when I started working at this store, it was totally new to me.
At first, we're like, this is funny, sure. And then it got to be, wow, they want to get rid of us.
Oh, yeah, it's been awful. I didn't really think about it because I was getting such good hours for a while. And now I'm getting, at the most 32 hours now.
And there's a lot of theft that goes on with these self-checkouts.
I had a woman come through self-checkout, and I watched her put stuff in the bag that she hadn't scanned, and then when it flagged the weight and I walked over to look, she insisted she scanned them, and it was such a fight, and I was dealing with four other stations. I had no choice. I just had to clear it.
To them, it's worth the price of saving labor is worth whatever people take. You know, what happened to people? We need people. We need that contact with people. We really aren't robots.
I could have, when I first started, I could have wanted to stay in this job for, my career. I loved it.
I actually went to college, and this is what I chose because I can change my schedule if I needed to go to school with my daughter. So people do choose retail. Those are not jobs that people choose not to have. And now I cannot go pick up and go somewhere else. And at 51 years old, quite frankly, no one's going to want to hire me.
Before this was a good job, it was okay to stay, but now it makes me want to get out of this industry because you don't know what the future holds.
Next to health care, which was the big story this week. The Supreme Court held 3 days of oral argument over whether to overturn the Obama health care reform. It's one-sixth of the economy hanging in the balance. And our healthcare reporter, Gregory Warner, had ringside seats, which I gather, and this is the extent of my inside information, I swear, they were hot tickets. On day one, he laid out with eloquent simplicity what was at stake. And I'm quoting him here. He said, "While every other developed country has some kind of health care for all system, we don't have one. That's really what the justices are deciding." And then on day two, he moved on to the individual mandate and also a cruciferous vegetable, broccoli, to be precise.
On the docket this morning was the individual mandate, the requirement that basically all of us have to have health insurance, up to and including having to buy it if we don't have it already. Our healthcare correspondent Gregory Warner was in the courtroom again today, as he was yesterday. Hey, Gregory.
Hey there, Kai.
All right, another big day for you, pal.
Huge day. And it's as if to underscore this, oh, it was horrible to watch, but 30 seconds into the Solicitor General's argument, I mean, he was stumbling words, he was clearing his throat, he drank some water, he lost his voice.
Like nerves, you think?
I mean, it could have been allergies, but yeah, it sounded like nerves.
All right, once he got going, what did he say?
The theme that kept coming up is what happens to the young, healthy person on the couch, you know, sitting there minding his business.
Yeah, right? You bet. I've been one of those.
Can the government make that person buy insurance? And the liberal justices on the court, they posed questions that suggested absolutely, because, you know, we never know when that person might get hit by a bus. And anyway, they're going to get older and sicker eventually. In Justice Kagan's words, the subsidizers become the subsidized. But conservative justices say, uh-oh, no way. This is an overstep of federal power. And here's Justice Kennedy from this morning's hearing.
And here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act. And that is different from what we have in previous cases.
Well,
that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
So this is Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, as we've been told oh so many times, but also raising this question about personal freedom, right?
Exactly. Though swing he did, I will say. Justice Kennedy, more than any justice this morning, was arguing both sides. Because at another point, he said, hey, look, that guy on the couch, he is part of the market for an actuarial reason, because in healthcare, we really are all in this together.
The young person who's uninsured is uniquely, proximately, very close to affecting the rates of insurance and the cost of providing medical care in a way that is not true in other industries. That's my concern in the case.
So take your pick. Kennedy 1, Kennedy 2.
Right.
That could be the fate of the healthcare law.
Uniquely, proximately, very close. I loved it. But but let me ask you a different question, maybe sort of blunt. Kennedy's talking about it, you know, we're all in this together. 80% of Americans, the vast majority of people, have health insurance or actually are that guy sitting on the couch who don't need it. So how big a deal is it for them?
I think there are really two answers to that question. One is, look, healthcare is what, one-sixth of our economy? It's on track to be one-fifth. So this law has major consequences for not only how the insurance market is based, but also how we control costs. But second, look, I mean, people want to make this about politics, and of course it is in some way, but we've been having this healthcare debate for almost 100 years, since 1914, and Teddy Roosevelt, and, you know, of course, they called him a socialist. So, I mean, so while every other developed country has some kind of healthcare for all system, we don't have one. That's really what the justices are deciding.
Yeah. There was another thing that caught my ear in the arguments today, and I'm sure you heard it as well. It was this issue of whether the government can force Americans to buy something.
And it was really one vegetable that symbolized this. Actually, broccoli was mentioned 8 times on the highest court in the land. And actually, Justice Scalia framed it in what has really become known in legal circles as the broccoli question, which is, as you said, if the government can make everyone enter this health insurance market, why not the food market?
So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
So how did broccoli become the symbol of the food that Americans don't want to be made to eat? Well, it might hail back to a pronouncement by George Bush Sr. on the tarmac in 1990.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it, and I'm president of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
That was the laugh track version that played on all the comedy channels long after. Kermit Roosevelt is a constitutional law professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
If the government actually tried to make you buy broccoli and eat it, I think there would be a constitutional problem with that.
But that's not what the individual mandate does, he says. Making people buy a policy is not the same as telling they have to go to the doctor. And grocers don't write off the cost of giving away billions of dollars of free broccoli and then jack up food prices for the rest of us.
Because we don't have the broccoli emergency rooms where people who first say they don't want broccoli then go and get it and make the taxpayers foot the bill.
But don't mention any broccoli emergencies to this guy.
Yeah, feel a little protective of it.
Thomas Bjorkman is director of the Eastern Broccoli Project at Cornell University. He's devoted the last 20 years, most of his career, to studying this particular vegetable.
I've gotten used to watching it grow. I guess it's like you're used to watching your pet behave in certain ways. I'm used to seeing the broccoli behave in certain ways.
And if he's learned one thing about broccoli, it's this. Most kids love it. It's the best-selling green vegetable. And when Bush said he hated it, broccoli sales shot up the next year. Which makes you realize, Kai, whatever the Supreme Court decides about health care, could be a great year for broccoli.
Wait, broccoli is the most popular green vegetable?
I know, but I like broccoli. You may not.
All right. Anyway, whatever. Gregory Warner at the Supreme Court for us. Gregory, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
I can't touch that. And so that's a wrap of the Remarket podcast for March 30th. I'm Mitchell Hartman in Portland, Oregon for Marketplace. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.